This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. I'm here with Dr. Torin Monahan, professor of communication at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Torin is enviably prolific, having written dozens of articles and 7 books on the social and cultural dimensions of surveillance systems, with a special focus on gender and racial inequality. Monahan is here to discuss his 2022 book with Duke University Press, Crisis Vision, Race and the Cultural Production of Surveillance. Torin, welcome to the Annex. So good to have you.
Thank you, Dan. It's really good to be here.
All right. Well, Torin, I really enjoyed reading your book, but I want to start with your title, Crisis Vision. So what did you want to convey with these words, both crisis, which immediately calls to mind about what and for whom, and vision as sense, capacity, and as productive of knowledge?
So good question. With crisis vision, I'm really trying to draw attention to the ways that vision is a form of or a mechanism of apprehending the world, of making sense of the world. So it's not a value neutral thing that you just passively view or see things, but instead it's a way of importing assumptions onto the world. And those, at least in this book, the ones I want to call attention to are those that are racializing assumptions, that are about power, that are about categorizing or sizing people up. So that's where the surveillance portion comes in. Crisis, though, you know, the connection that I'm making there is that we are in a time of crisis, all kinds of crises. That, you know, the book was composed largely during the early days of the pandemic, but we also have the racial reckoning. We also have climate change. We have all kinds of crises, wars around us. So from a more of a social science perspective or a critical perspective, I wanted to draw attention to how crisis then can precipitate a response to others, a response to policing borders or to surveilling others more intensely or to victimizing or perpetrating violence against others. So I wanted to get at the sense of conflict that is woven into vision as well. That's more of the theoretical orientation of the book.
I'm glad you're helping us unpack that. I thought the juxtaposition between these two terms, you know, vision is such a powerful metaphor in our academic world. Lots of our metaphors of knowing are visual, you know, to bring something to light or to, you know, to recognize it or, you know, to shine a light on something or to, you know, give a color or texture or nuance to that often is a visual capacity. And then comparing it or adding crisis to it is a provocative thing. So readers, if you're interested in thinking differently through some of the often taken for granted categories that academics use, this would be a good text to pick up.
Let me jump in for a second just to say, you know, this idea of shedding light on something or opening something up or exposing really does have it's a mode of scientific vision that really does have its origins in the scientific revolution that as I try to explore, at least in the introduction to the book, that this is also not value neutral. Like what we think of what you and I do as academics and our listeners do as academics, that this mode of trying to parse the world and illuminate it is also tied to these origins of extraction and warfare and exploitation, that it's not inseparable from that. So that's really like a through line that I try to weave, but it's a reminder for me at least to really be reflexive about the terms I use. Like I agonize trying not to say something like shine a light on, because once I've had that critique, what are other ways that other terms one could use to try to get at the process of making sense of the world that we do as social scientists? And it's difficult, but I think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah. Okay. That's really helpful and relates to, I think, something we were saying before we started recording, was just the fact that you use a lot of different kinds of terms to describe relations and being with. So even instead of uncovering something or shining a light on it, what if it's communing with or being in the presence of, you know, relating to those sorts of metaphors of presence and coexistence or in co-constitution that might be equally useful or also useful in describing relations between knowers and objects of knowledge or relations of knowledge.
Yeah, I like that because it recognizes that vision is about power. It is about asserting control over something, even if it's mastery of facts. We want to control them, like the language itself, you know, mastery of something should give us pause. And so I like that framing.
All right. Well, this segues nicely to the organization of your book. You could have organized this book in a number of ways, but you chose to create chapters on themes in artwork that deal with surveillance in some way. So this book is about what you call critical surveillance art in a variety of ways. So can you tell something about how you came to make that decision and how the chapters work together to illustrate your argument?
All right. So for the listeners who haven't read the book, it is a kind of book that engages with art on a fairly deep level, that I review a number of artworks, both visual as well as some performance pieces, some dance pieces. And these are artworks that are oriented toward intervening in surveillance in some way. So they're anti-surveillance or critical surveillance artworks. And I want to do a close reading, or I do a close reading of these works to see what can they contribute to our collective approaches to the problems surrounding surveillance. And I don't just mean artists or activists, but even scholars, policymakers. How do we conceptualize the problems of surveillance and then use those conceptualizations to imagine solutions? And so the artworks, what I found especially fruitful is by thinking about this problem through art, it freed me up to not rely on the same kind of crutches that I would otherwise rely on as a social scientist to say, okay, here's a problem. What's the solution? How does it translate? That's very limiting, I found. And by looking at it through art, it opened up other possibilities because it's not necessarily about a technical approach to solving a problem or diagnosing a problem. It's more about how to activate change or to conjure emotions or conflicts in viewers, or to really agitate people's comfort levels about issues. Okay, so that's in a nutshell how I approached art. The organization then runs somewhat, I think, a logical manner. It starts with more of the individual and individualized artworks that are focused on avoidance. Like how do I avoid surveillance in my life? So there's a lot of colorful art out there that engages with that topic. And then the book proceeds through these chapters of more like transparency, complicity, violence, and finally disruption, where it moves away from the individual more toward the institutional, I would say, or the structural, and finally concluding with a confrontation of the racialized nature of surveillance. And as you were saying, Dan, these ideas or experiments with achieving collectivity or community or survival in spite of that really violent context. That's the idea behind the organization.
I'm reading through the book and I'm getting into that first chapter about avoidance, or how people try to quite elaborate forms of makeup and styles of dress and masks and things to avoid visual surveillance or facial recognition technology, other kinds of things. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is exhausting work that who in the world, like really as a daily practice, could put on lots and lots of face makeup. And this is not just something that like is like sort of a typical routine for many women in our society, but far beyond that. So we can talk about aesthetic style and makeup and things like that, but we're talking about really inventive masking kinds of forms of face modification and masks and other sorts of things. And, you know, getting into these other chapters that are on the more structural or institutional level is kind of a relief because, boy, you know, asking all of us or many of us to do this kind of stuff is just be exhausting.
It would be maybe even more exhausting or impossible, depending on one's social position. So what I like about the engagement with the work in that early chapter, and I do talk about masking in the time of COVID and kind of the more of the masculinist approach that is embodied by our then President Trump. What I like about foregrounding that in that chapter is it really calls attention to privilege, and especially white privilege, so that the book's treatment of race is not just that surveillance is oppressive or violent toward racially marginalized populations, and it is, but also that there's more of this continuum of threat where, while that is true, there's also what I call a right to hide, that someone could feel like or believe that they shouldn't be singled out, that they are special in some way. And so this is really an articulation of white privilege. It's an articulation of class privilege and masculinist privilege. And that for me is a nice counterpoint, because as we were saying just a second ago, it should give us pause to think, when we want to assert we have a right to privacy, are we also then by the same token saying that others do not? And if so, how are those determinations made? And so that's what I'm trying to do here, is to really unsettle those impulses.
All right. Well, it's worth reading the book in part for this description of these avoidance strategies. And then, of course, as you say, the flip side of that argument. I want to move to the chapter on complicity, which is at least in part about how in many of our everyday lives, we participate and support surveillance systems, including oppressive ones or ones that have oppressive implications, without really recognizing it. It's sort of like the cultural and social and carceral water that we swim in. So in your chapter on complicity, you discuss Dries De Porta's piece, Jaywalking. Could you describe that project and talk about the work that you think it's doing?
Sure. Yeah. So Dries is a fabulous Belgian artist who does a lot of artworks that repurpose public surveillance streams, and in the process defamiliarizes them or makes them strange to us, so that we start to question, what are these data streams that we are swimming within and that we are contributing to? So for this particular project, he's grabbed video feeds from street corners throughout the world, in cities throughout the world, where you have these unencrypted cameras that are just up there filming people at intersections.
What?
Which is true. So he grabs these video feeds and then he processes them. He's built an algorithm to process them and determine when people are jaywalking or crossing the street when the light is clearly red. And then he creates a situation for museum goers. It's kind of funny that there's a big red button that a museum goer could press that would, if they want to report this person, this crime, to the authorities. And if they do so, it will send a screened capture of that individual to the local police department within that jurisdiction. And so whether or not, you know, the police would act on that, I don't think they would, but it creates a really tense situation for museum goers because they're confronted with this complicity. Like, if they choose to do this, it could have implications for someone's life. If they choose not to do it, it could also have implications for that person's life and maybe their own. So this is more of a philosophical term that developed by Louis Althusser, but it's interpolation. They are hailed as subjects by this artwork and they need to embody that subjecthood. So I like this work a lot because it makes people uneasy, and it also draws attention to these data valence systems that we're a part of that we might otherwise not even think about. But it also detaches from that museum space to help us reflect on these larger kinds of surveillance systems we're all contributing to, that we're complicit in, and that have, as we were saying earlier, maybe negative ramifications for individuals or for populations. So I like that as well, that it's like fostering awareness, but it's challenging viewers and it's inviting people to think about data in their lives. I'll put a plug in here for a great forthcoming book. I know this is a podcast about my book, but there's a great forthcoming book by Heather Woods called Threshold. And it's about smart homes in particular, from University of Alabama Press. And she does a wonderful job of really looking at the gender dimensions of this reproduction of domesticity with our smart home devices. And so keep on the lookout for that, because it connects to the pervasiveness of these systems and how we normalize them.
I thought the example of jaywalking was really striking as well, especially in the sense that these surveillance systems stand in for law enforcement often, And law enforcement is, I mean, I guess in the dominant telling, the hegemonic kind of telling is supposed to represent all of us in terms of keeping folks safe and providing a basic set of social order. But of course, we know that those systems and those agencies are not neutral with respect to major categories in social life in terms of race and class. Advantage and disadvantage, privilege and oppression. And one of the questions that comes up for me when I'm thinking about jaywalking is, you know, what is it that I want my state to be doing on my behalf? And then how is it that I'm empowered to ask that question or demand that the state respond to me as if I have a particular purchase on the state or a particular stake in it that maybe others aren't authorized to or don't have in terms of power and space in society.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, Dan, because it's also, you know, this is one of the challenges with studying surveillance is that oftentimes there's this impulse to want to, as we said at the outset, to shine a light on wrongdoings out there, or whether it's police misconduct or politicians or whomever. And that, in my mind, so this is what I try to get at also in the book, it participates in this, what I call a cultural production of surveillance. The way we talk about it also then reproduces it. So if we talk about it in the terms you just articulated of you want to draw attention to power differentials and privilege, that's one way of reproducing that that goes against the grain. If you talk about it in a more universal way of we're all subjected, we're all, you know, exposed, and that's not right. If you talk about it in a universal way, it papers over those differences that are not just semantic, they are embodied. So I really like that phrasing of the problem.
It reminds me of, like, I haven't seen The Watchmen, but it's like the who watches the watchers kind of thing. And it goes back to like the Black Panthers watching the police and surveilling the police. And even today, when a motorist is pulled over, like a Black motorist is pulled over, sometimes like a well-meaning or well-intentioned like white person will come and they will take out their phone and they will record the encounter. On the one hand, you want to say, okay, oversight of police encounters with motorists, particularly motorists from who are frequently over-surveilled, over-policed, and under-protected. You know, you want to say that's probably a good thing for accountability. On the other hand, the position of being able to document that and feel like that's a safe thing for you to do is bound up in the same kinds of social hierarchies and inequities that are embedded in the problematic that's being documented itself. There's a recursivity to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
At least in some forms.
Yeah, it's if we see surveillance as the corrective to surveillance, I think we're never going to break that cycle. And that doesn't mean that I'm opposed to accountability and justice, but I think we do have to be attentive to ways to break that cycle as well, because surveillance, at least in the field of surveillance studies, there is such a field. There's a recognition or a growing recognition that surveillance is always about an exercise of power. So if you see surveillance as the answer to surveillance, you are still just trying to reassert different forms of domination, forms of domination or control that align with your politics as opposed to with someone else's politics. So it doesn't necessarily equalize or move us beyond that agonistic or adversarial mindset. Which is why I know you will probably ask questions about this, but which is why I try to move toward alternatives that aren't that in the book, you know, with the idea of opacity or something else that is about a collective and not adversarial relations.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a perfect segue because the next question is about opacity. So you contrast crisis vision with opacity, and it's likely that listeners who are subscribed to the podcast will have heard my interview with Tom DeGloma. DeGloma wrote a book recently on anonymity and pseudonymity in everyday life. So with opacity, are you trying to describe a zone of freedom that might be both positive and negative in the sense of allowing certain activities while preventing others?
I don't know that I would characterize it that way. I With opacity, I'm really building upon the philosopher's work, Edouard Glissant, who is really focusing on an idea of irreducibility of subjects. And let me unpack that for a minute. That if we think about how most surveillance operates today, it is about reducing people, atomizing them to data elements. It is about segmenting populations and treating them differently. You know, do you get to go through TSA pre-check, or are you nominated for an enhanced interrogation or pat down? You know, all surveillance today, I think, with no exceptions I could think of, operates this way. It's not like the panopticon where everyone's exposed and we have this uniform social control that is instilled in us. Instead, contemporary surveillance is about reducing you to these data elements, these descriptors, and treating you differently based upon those assignments. So with opacity, and what Glissant is getting at with irreducibility, is that it would push back against that. It would try to create a space that where that was not the operating logic, that we're not trying to reduce people, size them up, stereotype them, but instead question what are the ways that we could coexist, that we could be collectives, that we can maybe survive or thrive apart from this larger system that is trying to kill a lot of us. So where are those spaces of survival and thriving that resist that overall liberal logic? So that's what opacity is trying to do. And for me, it's, I write about this in the book too, it's not at all what privacy is trying to do. So privacy is focused on individuals, it's focused on data elements, it's focused on a mobilization of rights, especially universal rights or human rights. And opacity, on the other hand, is focused on the collective. It's focused on not our data streams, but instead our relations with others. And it recognizes that the idea of universal rights is itself tainted, you know, irredeemably tainted at the outset. So it's really a different mode of thinking about resistance to surveillance than we usually use.
I think we're going to come back to the themes of liberalism and what our responses are to living amidst ubiquitous surveillance systems and tracking systems. And as you were saying earlier, data streams from our work, our travels across the internet, you know, through online shopping and tracking us with shopper rewards cards and all kinds of things, which aren't necessarily related to the art you talk about in your book, but do highlight how our everyday lives are marked by these continual interactions with surveillance in many ways. I mean, I'm currently at this on this in my building on campus here at the University of Alabama at Huntsville, and there are probably a dozen security cameras between my door and the exit to the building right now. And normally I'm not thinking about them too much, but they are present, right? I have no idea where the data goes or who's watching. But in any case, I bet many of our academic listeners and folks who are in other fields too can certainly relate to the idea of ubiquitous surveillance.
I'll just jump in because I was teaching my technology and social justice class yesterday and was telling the students about how we have moved to this Canvas edutech platform, and they wanted to know how is that different from the one before. And I told them the main way is it allows a lot more tracking, a lot more surveillance of you. So this, you know, in educational institutions, we are also complicit in these kinds of dynamics, and sometimes in ways we have little control over, right? You know, which contracts our universities have with platform companies. So we probably don't have a lot of say in that, but we are wrapped up in that enterprise.
Oh yeah, we're a Canvas campus as well. And I'm pretty sure there are some minimal requirements that we're all required to, minimal engagement we're supposed to have or have to have with that system. All right, I want to focus in on chapter 5, where you address art from the Black Lives Matter movement and its work for both survival and transformation. I thought this was a really engaging and in many ways inspiring chapter. So one piece you highlight is Stop, by an artist that goes by Dred Scott. So could you describe this artwork and how you think about it in relation to the movement and its context?
Sure. So Dred Scott is an American artist who does some amazing in-your-face confrontational artwork that is largely focused on calling attention to police violence or to racial violence in society. And then, as is a theme with our conversation today and a lot of these works, is I think also trying to implicate individuals or museum goers and for his installations, implicate them in these policing activities in some way, to draw attention to their unwitting participation. So Stop is one such installation of his that he, in this piece, he constructs video walls of dark-skinned men in two different locations, in Brooklyn and in Liverpool. So, across the pond. And you have a video wall on each side of this hallway where museum goers stand in between these larger than life representations of these men who stand and stare at museum goers. They don't shift their eyes away much. They're like, as if they're demanding recognition. And they slowly intone how many times they've been stopped by the police. So they'll say, "I've been stopped 50 times or more. I get stopped and frisked on a regular basis. I've been stopped here." So they begin to recount how many times they've been stopped by the police. And the artwork does something really clever, I think, with the audio pacing of these disclosures, because it starts out sparse and then they start to overlap each other until it almost becomes cacophonous. And then it peters out and they're just more patterned and regular. And for me, some of the analysis I do in the book about this is that it's signifying some of the normalization of these encounters with the police, that it becomes part of the backdrop, it becomes predictable. But it's no less stigmatizing for that. It's no less dehumanizing for that. And it's no less dangerous for that. And what I like also, I think, about this piece is it's for your question about the Black Lives Matter movement in particular, is that it's showing the ways that these mechanisms of police surveillance and intervention, these racialized forms of policing, are not unique to the United States. And in fact, police departments model best practices from each other so that they engage in similar kinds of policing practices in multiple regions, multiple states throughout the world. So there's a connection, there's a recognition of the similarities and experiences within a white supremacist society that is not specific to the US.
Right. We should just say for listeners, Dred Scott spells their name Dread Scott. I'm imagining that's a pseudonym or an artistic name. And of course, many folks will probably be familiar with the Dred Scott decision, which was a Supreme Court case here in the United States, where an enslaved man, Dred Scott, was taken to the North and then claimed his freedom because he was then living in a free state or a state without enslavement as a system. And of course, the decision came down against Scott, and he remained enslaved, as far as I know, for the rest of his life, or at least until the system of enslavement ended. So the name of this artist is super interesting in relation to this piece and perhaps some of their other work as well.
Yeah, it's definitely intentional, as you've noted. His real name is Scott Tyler, and he's like been very upfront with wanting to underscore these connections between the present and the past. So that's something that a lot of the works in chapter five, that the artworks in chapter five that I analyze, are doing this. They're trying to show what Sadia Hartman has called the afterlife of slavery. They're showing how it lives on in the present, how it rearticulates in the present, that it's not something that is in the past tense, but instead it's just found new forms, which is not, I think, a shocking claim to who I would imagine would be the listeners of this podcast.
You may be right, Torin. I did want to follow this up, the related to Hartman and some of the other theoretical frameworks you use in chapter five. So also in chapter five, you draw on Sharpe's concept of the wake to tie together anti-blackness and surveillance. So could you help us understand or explain the concept of the wake and tell us how surveillance furthers anti-blackness?
Okay, that's a big question. I'll see how far I could get in answering it. For the wake, so this is Christina Sharpe's work. She has a wonderful book called In the Wake, where my experience reading it, truthfully, is I was blown away. It's so poetic. It like weaves together personal biography with critical theorization, with attention to Black creative expression. So it's really, really sharp text. And the wake as a concept for her signifies in multiple ways. It's signifying this afterlife of slavery that we've been talking about. We're trailing in the wake of slavery and its ripples are still, you know, permeating our societies. The wake is also a kind of mourning of the dead, that we recognize people have been lost to this. There is a sense of loss that shouldn't be ignored, that should be contended with, should be processed. And then the part that I really like, or one of the parts I really like, is then the wake is also a challenge. It's a injunction for us to awaken, to try to move towards something new, something different. And so the front cover of the book is this piece by Hank Willis Thomas called Raise Up, that is, you know, a depiction of, it's a sculpture of these Black men, men of color, who we see their backs and part of their torsos, that they have their hands raised over their head, and they're being like subsumed by this white platform that the sculpted piece rests upon. So for this, you know, this is also a kind of, you know, raise up is both, you know, conjures the idea of hands up, don't shoot. It is about raising up for inspection. And it was featured as a piece in South Africa, you know, to draw attention to the kinds of inspection that were commonplace for in the apartheid regime. But it also then, I think, connects to this idea of how can we raise up? How do we move beyond this totalizing white edifice of white supremacy so that we can come to something new? So that's, you know, that's one way in this chapter I kind of connect the theoretical apparatus of what Christina Sharpe and others are doing, more of a trend in Black scholarship called Afro-pessimism. So try to draw attention to the foundational problems of the liberal order, but at the same time, as we talked about previously, what are the spaces of opacity or survival or movement, maybe not beyond, but outside of, or in the fissures of that white supremacist order?
This is a good segue to a question that I had about these critical surveillance art projects. Are there some capacities or some attributes that these works share that make them more or less successful?
I don't know the answer to that. I guess it would depend on the audience and what they were trying to get out of these artworks. That I think most of them are, the ones I selected anyhow, I think they are all moving in different ways. They are all successful in different ways. Even the ones that are more of the focused on avoidance and individual ways of blocking surveillance, that obviously resonates with populations, with audiences, that people want to know more and to find ways to protect themselves better. Some of the works we haven't talked about are those that are drawing attention to and problematizing the idea of transparency. That I write about Trevor Paglen's work, for instance. He does these amazing photographs of sites of surveillance, some Black sites in Afghanistan, or you know, the satellite installations in the UK, or in the US, you know, the like NSA sites, where the idea is not just to make it transparent so that we see it, but he creates these artworks that the photography is intentionally blurry, almost like in vast, sublime. It's as if he's trying to conjure a landscape painting so that one is positioned within it when you are viewing these things. So that's a different kind of success. You know, it's in the register of transparency, but it's also doing something different apart from transparency. So they're all successful in different ways. For what I think is at the heart of your question is, you know, which ones I would say achieve or work toward opacity. It would be these ones that maybe are less focused on the technologies per se, or, you know, the state apparatus, or, you know, the gadgets, or the facial recognition systems, less focused on the technologies and more focused on the social structures or the cultural dynamics. So those pieces like Dred Scott's or like Hank Willis Thomas's or others in that vein that are really tackling the racial dimensions of exposure directly. For the purposes of the goals of this book, I would say those are the ones that are the most successful.
That's really helpful. I mean, your discussion of the photographer who takes these images and they're slightly, as you say, intentionally blurry. There's an illustration of one of these in your book. It's a site in England with these facilities that for signals surveillance, like satellite kind of, I don't know what it is, but basically like they're looking at digital, they're trying to collect digital information or some kind of signals. But these facilities look like golf balls on like little squat tees, more or less. And of course, we have no idea what's going on in there. You know, it's not like there's a key that says, you know, this building is for analyzing email traffic, and this one's for, you know, Twitter traffic, and this one's for, yeah, visual images on Instagram or whatever. So in some ways, these systems are, for the people who live there, like they're kind of hiding in plain sight in the same way that, you know, these traffic cameras are and the surveillance cameras in our academic buildings and other technologies we routinely interface with.
Yeah, I think that's right, Dan, that there's a normalization across the board of surveillance. And that's why most of these artworks that I analyze are especially good at this tactic of defamiliarization, that they shake it up and really call on us to interrogate those systems anew. So one other one that we haven't talked about is Jacob Geltner's work. He does these surveillance camera satellite dish installations where you could be like ones in Bondi Beach or in, you know, along the shores of Aarhus in Denmark. You know, you have all these cameras, like CCTV cameras, that are perched like seagulls, and which is a really wonderful image. I've used it as a cover of a different book of mine, the Surveillance Studies Reader. But by taking these everyday objects and putting them in different configurations, it does call attention to them so that they invite scrutiny again, or maybe for the first time. And that's also a way of where art can do something that a policy brief cannot, or maybe a journal article, even in a top tier journal, cannot. But art like can confront publics in these ways that are really, I think, enticing or are active.
I think that's right. You know, as great as some of the top journals in sociology are, it's the rare one that gets featured in public space and discussed and pondered over, and people are either confused by it or they are unsettled by it. They can be unsettled by it because it becomes an object for partisan gamesmanship, but most of the time, most of the things that are published don't break through the wall, so to speak. Well, we've mentioned liberalism a few times, and I think this is definitely a theme in your text. And so as I was reading, I kept thinking about the state of liberalism and by extension, liberal democracy. This is a little bit of a running theme in some of the conversations I've been having on this show. And on page 139, you write, quote, "Crisis vision festers within the inherent contradictions of liberal humanism." So for those listeners who may not be very familiar with the critique of liberal humanism, can you help us understand what you're pointing to here?
Okay. The idea with this particular critique is that the liberal project was really founded on slavery, colonization, and dispossession. So if you think there was an Enlightenment period where these states founded on universal human rights or dignity or liberty came about, that this is a strand of scholarship, and I think it's becoming much more popular, much more, I think, much more normalized itself, that focuses on how those, the very things we cherish or value about the liberal order, were made possible because of the extraction, colonial extraction, because of slavery, because of dispossession, that those states would not have thrived or formed or even had the same kind of philosophical foundations if it weren't for them being able to exist because of others. So if that's true, and this is one of I think, the principles that the book operates upon. If that's true, then what is the next step? How do we alter that, confront that, challenge that? And I would say that the next step is not necessarily trying to reform that system or try to make it more inclusive, in the same way that the defund the police campaigns are not about police reform, which is seen as a very conservative approach to the problems of police violence, but instead abolition. So similarly, if we think about the liberal project in these ways or the liberal order, then protecting people's rights better or including more people in the group that has rights that are protected is not going to change that underlying dynamic. The underlying dynamic is one of an erasure of Black and Brown subjecthood. That, as we were talking about earlier, I think about this as a continuum of threat. That the very grounds on which we as white subjects could say we're entitled to something simultaneously is implying this silent statement of others are not, or maybe not as much, or not in the same way. So that's what the critique of liberalism is in the context of this text.
Okay, that's really helpful and super thought-provoking. I want to read the final paragraph from your book, spoiler alert, and follow up on this previous question. So here's the passage. The flight to opacity is a flight away from surveillance. It is not about watching the watchers, dyadic resistance, or a retreat into privacy. Instead, it is about securing spaces for collective existence without being categorized and sorted, without being atomized and diminished. It is a project more radical than reform or accommodation within social hierarchies because it questions the very basis for those hierarchies. It questions promises of inclusion and rights when they are consistently foreclosed. It is not a destination, but instead a commitment to being in the weave with others without boundaries. A nicely poetic conclusion, Torin.
Thank you.
Do you want to say more about the prospects for, I don't know what we're calling this post, if you call it post-liberalism, you're always referring to the thing that you're trying to move beyond, similar things with postmodernism. You want to say more about what comes after, about the weave?
Okay, I hope the weave comes after. I'm not sure that it does. That is the aspiration, that one of the approaches here is what I'm beginning to conceptualize as more of emancipatory collectives. Like, what are the possibilities apart from this liberal order, apart from the state? And there are models for this. So fortunately, it's not dependent on my creativity or other academics' creativity for this. You could look at what are the models there. And one model that I really like, this is a more historical one, is what Alondra Nelson, sociologist Alondra Nelson, writes about in her book Body and Soul, is like how the Black Panther Party instituted public health that was completely apart from the state, like a recognition the state is not going to do this, and it might have other interests in mind for Black bodies. And so let's have this be more ground up, community-based, collective. You see some elements of this, I think, with various kinds of anti-surveillance collectives now. There's a project, the Anti-Eviction project in the Bay Area, and I'm sorry, anti-eviction mapping project. So it's doing some of this work of calling attention to the precarity and the vulnerability of people who are being deprived of housing, but it's also doing it in a way that is about pooling resources. So you could have data scientists, and you could have community activists, and you could have poets, and you could have artists and others who are really coming together to create a space, create a project that is different from what the state would do. So these, to be clear, these are not in the book, but these are maybe alternatives that could come after. If you're thinking more linearly, though, Dan, I would say I'm not that optimistic about that we're going to reach and after per se, that we have all kinds of crises. We've got, rise in ethno-nationalism and climate change and authoritarianisms that, if anything, I think the trend is headed in the other direction. We do have what my good colleagues, Steve Graham and David Murakami would write about as a form of neo-feudalism that is arising, that emerges both through fortified borders and enclaves, the gated communities and the separations, but it also occurs in digital spaces with these very powerful platform companies that are operating apart from the state and don't even rely on the state in large part, like the Amazons of the world that have their own jurisdictions, their own laws, their own codes of conduct that supersede the state in a lot of ways. So I think neo-feudalism is probably where we're moving at the same time that I would hope we would try to embrace some of these more progressive alternatives.
Maybe there is no one, well, I don't think there is one solution or one end point. The search for such a thing is probably a fool's errand, and many people take inspiration from the idea that freedom is a constant struggle. It's a temporary, precarious, always fragile accomplishment that needs to be renewed consistently, on an ongoing basis. Okay, well, that is a vision for the future, Torin. You may well be right, and there are certain there's a lot of evidence about not only, I mean, there is the independence of the state from these transnational, global corporations that you mentioned, but there's a lot of complicity in just in terms of how even laws and policies were originally intended to provide some ballast to corporate power have been distorted and reframed in ways that make organizing and solidarity much more difficult for regular folks, and that fuel this neo-feudalism that your colleagues are talking about. Incidentally, Ruha Benjamin has a new book coming out about imagination that I'm looking forward to, that may have some things to say along these lines. But I do have one final question before we turn to our more lighthearted banter segment, Torin. You finished this book, it's out into the world, it's making an impact, and happy to discuss it here with you. But what are you working on now? The perennial academic question, once you publish something, isn't the next question, what's coming down next?
If we're doing it right, I suppose. Distract ourselves from the previous stuff and move on to things that might enliven us in the future. I am envisioning a project, so I have some grant proposals out. We'll see what happens, but it would be more a collaborative, multinational project working with colleagues in the UK and also in Canada to look at activist responses to police surveillance. So especially if there are programs like Pegasus or others that are trying to spy on journalists and spy on activists, and what to really question what is the chilling effect perhaps of police surveillance of these democratic movements. And a portion of that I think that I'm especially intrigued by is maybe even police surveillance of the far right. Like, how might that also be contributing to polarization or divisions, political divisions? Because there's some evidence maybe that could fuel these groups' ideas of persecution and lead to even further radicalization. So that's a hypothesis, to be clear. That, what are we doing when we, across the political spectrum, when we turn to the police as the response? So that's a project I would like to do, and it would be, as I said, comparative with colleagues in other countries and other jurisdictions, and hopefully I will have the chance to do it.
All right, well, funders,
Yeah.
Torin is fundable. Torin and his colleagues are fundable.
Yeah, please listen. Yeah, I'm sure they're all tuned in.
Hey, we break news here on the NX, so that's part of our mission. Well, let's go ahead and turn to the rest of life outside of maybe ongoing or future research projects and writing. Have you seen any good art or music or other work that maybe does or doesn't connect to the themes we've been talking about?
Sure. The one thing that comes to mind, I have a long-standing admiration for the artist Peter Gabriel, especially his earlier work. And he's, for those of you who don't know, he's been involved with Amnesty International for many years and like really dedicated to calling out abuse and violence throughout the world. So he does have he's not gone away yet, apparently. He does have a new album out, and a colleague of mine, Greg Weiss, turned me on to this, that one of the approaches he's taking, and he has a song along these lines too, is called Panopticon with an M, that can we turn to our smartphones and our media outlets and more like guerrilla media, along the lines, I should say, of like forensic architecture or Bellingcat, that are like these investigative grassroots journalism that tries to unearth human rights violations. So it's like more in the trenches kind of investigation that is really against the grain. So that's the idea, behind, I think, that Peter Gabriel's after, like, can we shed a light on these other atrocities? Which, I admire the work of forensic architecture and Bellingcat, and but as you might suspect, given our conversation over the last hour, the impulse to reach for transparency as a corrective does make me wonder if that is the most powerful response.
All right, so Peter Gabriel, everyone, well, at least, there's a lot of good art that's just there's a lot of art that's just interesting to think with, whether or not we necessarily agree, or we can obviously recognize the limitations of almost any, pretty much any piece of production, what, whatever of piece of art or any kind of work, right? I mean, who among us has written something that couldn't be criticized? Perhaps none of us.
How about you, Dan? Are there works that have drawn your attention?
Well, I have been really interested in thinking about representations and alternative histories, particularly about the rise of fascism and responses to the rise of fascism and the aftermath of it. There are several pieces of art. Philip K. Dick has the story about, what if the Germans had won World War II and the partition of the United States into the Western part is like the West Coast is controlled by Japan, and the East Coast and up, I guess, up to around Chicago or so is controlled by the Germans. Recently, I finished watching both seasons of The Hunters on Amazon, which is about this group of Nazi hunters in the mid to late 1970s with Al Pacino and some other folks. It's a thought-provoking series about vengeance and justice and how justice is elusive, even for often people who have a very strong moral sense of right and wrong. In that series, there happens to be a connection to Wernher von Braun, who is a German Nazi SS officer and rocket scientist who played a pretty pivotal role in bringing space flight to the United States. So his character, or a person playing him, makes an appearance in Hunters, which has a nice Huntsville connection, since the Marshall Space Flight Center where Von Braun worked is here in Huntsville, Alabama. But I've also been listening to a lot of podcasts and also to audiobooks. I have a not terribly long commute, but 25 minute or so commute. And so that's good to get in some audiobooks and podcasts. And I've been interested in a couple recently. I mean, like many people, I listen to Know Your Enemy. It's probably it's a pretty popular podcast, also related to politics and rising authoritarianism in the United States and political movements. One that I just started listening to is Academic Edgelords. And I had no idea what an edgelord was when I started to listen to this. So I don't know if you've heard about this one, Torin.
No, that's new to me.
I think it's a relatively new podcast. It's mostly early career political theory graduate student people who are lovely and wonderful. But an edgelord apparently is someone who intentionally makes provocative arguments, and they focus on mostly peer-reviewed journal articles and other writing that takes very sort of far out there stances, and then they talk about them. So that's been interesting to listen to, and they're asking themselves, you know, what edgelord takes do they have, although mostly they're left-wing DSAers and people like that. I'm probably mischaracterizing them. So if you are listening, Academic Edgelords, I apologize for any incompleteness in this description, but I do appreciate what I've heard so far. So
us academics love to talk shop and to, you know, talk about the politics of what we do and what others do. So that sounds like a really good tip.
I can't tell you how many times we on the NX have been interviewing somebody or talking to someone who's not a sociologist or not a professional academic. And the metaphors we return to are all about our jobs. I think this is an occupational hazard where many times we find connections between, not that they're not there, but that our work lives are often intense. And because we carry around our minds with us a lot of the time, almost all the time, it can be difficult to figure out where the switch is between on and off when it comes to our academic interests and or obsessions.
I couldn't agree more. I would also maybe go a step sideways and say the system is also set up to inculcate us in those ways and in those behaviors. Like we self-exploit on a regular basis because we mesh our identities with the work that we do. And that's, I think, by design. Yes, it's not all self-selection. It's the reward system as well.
Oh yeah, and certainly socialization. So we not that this is a thing that people that mars our conversation or changes it in any way, but I said it on one of Torin's classes when Torin, you were on the faculty at Vanderbilt. And so I was among a bunch of other graduate students at that time. And that's certainly part of that class is certainly part of my like intellectual formation. And of course, as part of the graduate student socialization process into academic life. And, you know, to some extent, the folks who made it out and got academic careers, you know, we are considered the survivors, right? Even though many people who chose different pathways are having lovely lives, and I am appreciative of their example.
Well, I was glad to have that connection with you, and also that you have survived. And by all accounts, you seem to be thriving too. So it's really good to see.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Torin. It's great to have you on. Please, folks, check out the book. It is an engaging read. There are a lot of there's a lot of craft in this book. So if you enjoy good academic writing that has a pace and builds to a creative and thoughtful argument, Crisis Vision, I think, is for you.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate that.
Always good to see you, Torin. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks very much to my guest, Dr. Torin Monahan from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks also to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab, and to our fantastic producers. Music by Lena Orsa. Thanks, Lena.